Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Namaste Radio. The intent of our programming is to increase awareness, inspire loving action, and ignite transformation and healing in our listeners, and through them, our world. Namaste Radio is brought to you by Namaste Publishing. Please join its interactive spiritual community. Communicate directly with authors, guest bloggers, and others like yourself who are spiritually seeking a better way of living. Connect, make friends, and be one with our new Namaste Global community at namastepublishing.com. And now, please welcome your host for this hour, Marie Bernard, on Namaste Radio, radio that will change your life.
Welcome to Namaste Radio. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. I hope you are having a wonderful evening, or if you're listening to this on podcast, I hope you're having a wonderful day. And today's guest is Donald Altman. He is a psychotherapist, former Buddhist monk, and adjunct professor at Lewis and Clark College Graduate School and Portland State University. He conducts mindful living and mindful eating workshops nationally, and he's a member of the Burma Buddhist Monastery Association. And he is author of The Mindfulness Code, Keys for Overcoming Stress, Anxiety, Fear, and Unhappiness. And that's the topic of today's show. So welcome to the show, Donald.
Oh, well, hi, Marie. It's really nice to be here with you.
Thank you for taking the time to talk about your book with us. So you used to be a Buddhist monk. Can you tell us about how you got involved with that? And previously, I guess you're not doing that anymore.
Sure. I'm not a monk anymore. I still have the hairstyle. But I'm not a monk anymore. And actually, the reason I went into the monastery was very much related to mindfulness, because I had had some lifelong issues with food related to mindless eating. And actually, at the same time, I'd also met this monk. His name was Uthilananda. I'd written a book called The Four Foundations of Mindfulness, a very well-known teaching monk. And I was really had never met anybody quite like him. He just had a wonderful sense of compassion and a sense of availability, a readiness to help. And so I wanted to really know how did people turn out like that, because I really hadn't met too many people in Western culture like that. He was from Burma. And then I found out I had the opportunity to ordain with him as the head of the monastery, and it was really a wonderful experience for me, both in really learning some very powerful lessons about mindfulness, and that kind of propelled me into writing. My writing career changed as a result of that. Before that, I was writing a lot of different kinds of things for documentaries, even for a children's TV show. But then I turned toward self-help and spiritual-oriented writing, and then that propelled me toward becoming a psychotherapist. So I really couldn't have predicted that becoming a monk would have changed my life to the degree that it did, and I feel very grateful for that.
And Donald, you do a lot of work with around eating disorders. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I do. And the mindfulness code just has a little bit of eating disorders in there, but I did work in the eating disorder field, wrote some books in that area, and I'm still a member on the board of directors of an organization called the Center for Mindful Eating. And if anybody's interested, they could look that up. It's tcme.org. And what TCME does is really kind of work with professionals, therapists, dietitians, other people in the healthcare field that want to bring these ideas of mindfulness into their practices. So I'd worked in an eating disorder clinic, actually, for about 3.5 years in Portland, and I was kind of the mindfulness guy. I would bring in some mindfulness techniques, and I actually talk about one of the stories that I'd like to actually share with your audience that is in the mindfulness code, about when I went into the clinic one day. And there was a group of maybe 12 or 14 women and a lot of them were adolescents, actually, and maybe there were some in their 20s, a couple in their 30s. But the thing about eating disorders I want to just tell everybody is that of all the different mental health issues for women, that has the highest mortality rate. And what happens is that they have had, people with eating disorders get very, very stuck in their thoughts. And you wouldn't think that a fantasy could really harm you, but in this case, living in this fantasy could actually take your life. So on this particular day, I went into the group, and I started to lead the group, and I don't even remember what kind of group it was, but I noticed they were all really struggling. And I said, what's going on? And so one of the girls raised her hand, and she said, we're really struggling today with our eating disorder thoughts. And so I decided to veer off the normal what we were going to do that day in group, and I said, I want everybody to try something new here. We're going to all really explore this room in a very detailed way. And they kind of scoffed at that. They laughed and said, no, come on, Donald. We know this room. And, many of them, they would get there. It was an intensive outpatient program, so they'd get there at maybe 7 in the morning, 7:30, and then would have their meals there with supervision with a therapist, and then would leave at about 6 o'clock at night. And many of them were there for, 2 or 3 months, even longer. And so they said, do we really know this room? And I said, just humor me. Let's go walk around. And so they got up, and I guided them around the room by looking at the extreme detail of things, engaging their curiosity. Look at the little cracks on the wall. Notice the little bumps where the paint is maybe scratched off, how the light comes in through the window and washes against the floor. What does it feel like as you're walking and you're feeling your foot move in your shoe and pressing on the concrete floor? Even having them look at the grain on the table that they sat at every day. Where was the grain kind of worn? Was the table worn? Were the patterns of the wood symmetrical there? And so on. So I even had them look up at the heating vents and really listen moment by moment to hear what it sounded like. And so we did this, and I had them sit down. I said, that was 15 minutes, and they looked kind of surprised. But the next question I asked them really shocked them. I said, so tell me, where were your eating disordered thoughts? And, Marie, if you'd have been there, you'd have seen every jaw drop because they left their fantasy world. And one of the girls raised her hand, and she said that. She said, I feel like I left my fantasy for the real world for a little time, and it was really amazing. And another girl said, yeah, and I also know I don't like my fantasy being interrupted. And so imagine having your life stolen away by your mind, by your thoughts, an uncontrolled mind, an untamed mind. And what mindfulness does, and I'm not talking about imagination or creativity, which is very wonderful, but I'm talking about when your mind can actually steal away your precious moments. And so this was very much of a victory for these young women, for them to be able to leave that for just a little bit and to give them the hope that maybe they could start to sustain that and to see what it was like to leave that place. So so even though I worked in an eating disorder, I learned a lot about how to work with people, getting them into the body. Eating disorder patients typically are very dissociated from the body. In fact, the mindfulness code has a section called the body key. There's 4 different keys in the book. There's the mind key, and I think that's where I talked about getting out of the fantasies. And then there's the body key. There's a spirit key and relationship key, but the body key is very much about having us get back into the body. I think that we're very much a mind-centered culture where our heads are spinning with ideas all the time. We're thinking about the future a lot, maybe thinking about the past. And what happens is that we're kind of out of our senses. It's one way of thinking about it. And how can we come back to our senses, back to our home, which is what I think the body is. And I'd like to just maybe guide your audience in a brief little experience right now that would get them to use the body in a very present moment way. Is that okay?
Yeah, that would be great.
Great. Okay. So what I want everybody to do, and I call this palming the present moment, okay, is what I want you to do is to place your hands in front of you, in front of your heart center, and just slowly bring your hands together until your fingertips are touching, then more closer and closer until your palms touch. Now I want you to feel, is there heat building up between your palms right now? Now press a little harder, moving your elbows out to the side. By the way, don't do this if you're driving. My little disclaimer. And now as you're pressing hard, I want you to notice, is there tension that's coming up through the wrist? Can you feel it? How about in the elbow? Even up to the shoulder, maybe even in the back, between the shoulder blades or something. And now on the count of 3, 2, 1, slowly release. Let your palms separate. Keep your fingertips touching. And notice how the heat is coming off. Is there coolness now in the palms? Can you feel what it's like to have the tension released now in your hands and elbows and wrists and so on? So what you're experiencing right now, was that yesterday? Was that tomorrow? Of course, those are rhetorical questions. I mean, what the body does is really bring us back into the present moment, and it's really powerful in that way. It also has a lot to do, actually, with relationships, because when we check in with the body, actually, there's been a lot of research that shows that if people are aware of what their body is feeling, they're more in touch with their emotions. If you're more in touch with your emotions, you're going to be able to be more in touch with another person. So I think there are a lot of ramifications when you think about getting back into the body, and I think it's one of the most valuable and I think satisfying things that we can do.
Well, thank you for sharing that exercise with us.
Oh, sure.
I'm curious.
It takes 30 seconds. I encourage people to just do it throughout the day if you feel that you're getting too anxious or your mind is spinning.
And did you learn that through being a monk, or is this something that you picked up?
No, that's just something that I picked up. What I've tried to do is I've taken, because mindfulness can get a little complex sometimes. I mean, in terms of the more traditional way of looking at it, what I think I'm good at doing is taking some of these concepts and just making and bringing them into daily modern living, because I'm a Westerner, and being able to adapt them and help people adapt them, not to just adopt them the way they were originally taught, but to help us adapt. And I think adaptation, flexibility actually is a part of mindfulness. And so I came up with the palming the present moment idea and a lot of other ideas that were ways that I thought would make it more fun to bring mindfulness into your life. Because I've heard people say, I'm already so busy, and so I can't think of adding one extra thing in. Actually, the mindfulness, if you really think about it, is how you relate to whatever is happening in your life. You're not really adding anything on, but you're actually integrating and changing your relationship. So let's say you're stressed out. I saw somebody who had a tremendous amount of anger. In fact, he had very little impulse control over his anger, and he got actually fired from his job. And if he was in his car driving, he would make what he called an unkind gesture to other
drivers. I can imagine what that would be.
I mean, we're not going to inflict that upon your audience. And so what he would do is, he couldn't calm himself down. And he came to me and he said, I've just always been angry. And he was very skeptical of that I'd be able to do anything with him. But what I did was I said, look, I want to really work with you on the breath and to help you learn how to breathe in a new way. He said, I already breathe. I said, well, it's true. You already breathe. And I said, that's the advantage. We have to breathe anyway. We might as well do it in a way that actually calms down the brain and the body. And so what I did was I taught him a way of breathing that literally is like the air conditioner system of the brain and the body. It cools the limbic system. That's the inner core of the brain that sits up atop the brainstem, and it is always scanning for something that could go wrong. I mean, it's like Velcro for negativity there in that part of the brain. And so we need to know how to look within, notice our body state or our mental state, and how to calm that down. So I taught him this breathing, and he really worked out. I have to give him a lot of credit. He really practiced, and I gave him little stickers to put around when he would see a sticker. Let's say he put it on his clock or on his mirror at home, then he would practice the breathing right then. And he brought his breath from the chest. His breath, he was breathing very much up in his chest, which means that you're going to be vulnerable to the stress response, alert and alarm system of the body. This is the built-in flight or fight system that we have in us. And this is hardwired in the brain. So how can we actually overcome that? It turns out that we can use the frontal lobe, that's the part of the brain behind the forehead, to practice sending more signals back, calming down that limbic system, that inner reactive part of the brain. And when you decide you're going to breathe, you can notice your body state, you can notice your tension, notice your stress. Then when you make the choice to breathe, instead of giving the unkind gesture, you have actually started to rewire your brain. And that's actually what I talk a lot about in the Mindfulness Code. And I think it's one thing that makes this book a little different from any other mindfulness book out there, is I really talk a lot about brain science, the new brain science, and how you're able to rewire your brain for peace, joy, and happiness using mindfulness. So what this guy did was, after he practiced this, he was really surprised. I mean, he was kind of shocked. He said, somebody cut me off and I was able to keep my hands on the steering wheel. I didn't give him the unkind gesture. But he said the weird thing was, he said, I kind of noticed the anger, but I wasn't letting it bother me. So he changed his relationship to the anger. It's not like mindfulness is a magic pill that will instantly get rid of all those people that are cutting us off, or what some have called the irritating idiots in the world. Sometimes we're the irritating idiots, sometimes it's someone else, but someone is always going to be pushing a button, right? And we can't change that. We're not going to be able to change the situation a lot of the stress that we may be dealing with. But we can change how we decide to react to it and respond to it. And that's what mindfulness does. It gives us the ability to respond in a whole new way. And that is that's really very liberating and very empowering, because you have the choice how you want to lead your life. And if you feel that you're stuck or felt hopeless in certain situations, this can change that, because once you have greater awareness, you have greater choice, and it's a wonderful place to be, I think.
So, Donald, it sounded like your patient still experienced the anger. The mindfulness didn't make that anger completely go away, but what it did is it gave him a little bit of space from that anger, so he wasn't like swimming right in it. He was able to see that he was experiencing it.
Right. I like what you said there, because I actually use the word space a lot, and I like what you said about that he gave him some space from the anger. And I think what mindfulness can do is give us a healthy distance, healthy space. We can notice anger. We can notice our feelings. We can notice our frustration or irritability or whatever, but we don't have to give in to it. We can be with it. I'm not saying that we want to escape it. I mean, it's real, too, but if it's not going to be beneficial, if it's going to harm you or harm another, then maybe there's another way to go, to still get your needs met, but not to have to create more entanglement, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually he found that he was able to, with the breathing, because once you do the breathing, you, at a very profound level, you change your whole body chemistry. So this breathing, it lowers your blood pressure, respiration rate, pulse rate, and it cleanses out lactate from the blood. Lactate is a chemical in the blood that actually creates feelings of anxiety. it also produces serotonin. I don't know if you know what that is, but serotonin is a neurotransmitter, and a lot of people who are on antidepressant medication are on medication that is allows serotonin to be in the brain longer. But this natural breathing method, and why I like mindfulness, is that, you know, you've got 65 million people in the northern hemisphere here, at least 65 million, with anxiety and depression, clinical anxiety and depression, which means many of them are taking medication. But if you were to practice mindfulness methods, you could do a lot of this naturally. And I know a lot of people that come to see me, and I'm not saying don't ever take those things. I think they have a place. But I think that it's worth trying naturally to get our body in tune, to become a better fit with our environment. And so the breathing can help do this.
Well, and Donald, it's interesting what you say about the serotonin, because a lot, and also because you work with people with disordered eating patterns, and one of the things that we all know, we all have our comfort foods, and they're carby and sweet, and the carbohydrates, I mean, that gives your brain a boost of serotonin.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's kind of funny to think that, I mean, you can use food, and hey, I used to be an emotional eater, and you can definitely use food to give you that boost of good feeling, but it's pretty temporary, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I want to share a little funny story. I mean, when I was in my 20s, just got out of college, and didn't have a job, didn't have any kind of relationship, had to move back home, live with my parents, and I was kind of lonely. But what I did have, I lived in Chicago at the time, there was this great delicatessen that they just had the most wonderful rice pudding. And I loved rice pudding, so I would go there. This is going to date me too, but so I would go there in the morning and get back home just in time, about 11 in the morning, I think it was, just in time to watch The Dating Game. So that, you know, that rice pudding, maybe it gave me some temporary way to deal with my loneliness, but it really didn't work. And that's the frustration and the guilt. What happens a lot of times with emotional eaters is they get frustrated and they feel guilty about it. And then it creates a cycle where that guilt then feeds into them wanting to feel better again, and they'll eat more. So it doesn't really work. And yet also when we're under stress, we are not producing the amount of serotonin that we need. When we're not producing enough serotonin, our brain can actually get stuck. It's like a gear in a car that doesn't move into the next gear. And when your brain gets stuck like that, you could ruminate on thoughts, you could dwell on things, and you just feel negative. They've actually shown, and I talk about studies in the book, where mindfulness has shifted the brain function, and actually it shifts because you're releasing more serotonin, that's also through the breathing, but you're shifting the brain function and you're wiring around that negativity and actually improving your immune system at the same time. Because when you're under stress for a long period of time, and I don't want to turn this into a physiology session, but I think it's really fascinating what happens, is that the cortisol that stays in the body, cortisol in the short term, of course, is an anti-inflammatory, and it helps you if you're possibly going to be attacked or have a survival need. But in the long term, what happens? The cortisol, it actually puts the brakes on your immune system. It kills off T cells, which help fight different kinds of diseases. It diminishes the number of NK, or natural killer cells, in the body. They fight tumors and some kind of viruses. So you're really talking about, you know, compromising your immune system if you're allowing yourself to be under stress. Even not sleeping for up to 3 days can put your body in a chronic stress state. And by the way, the chronic stress state will also drive a desire for sugar and other high-calorie foods, because your body, there's a whole complex interplay between stress and appetite, and so it actually pushes you into eating unhealthily.
Well, that's probably why people who work the graveyard shift tend to not eat as healthfully as people
probably.
Who work regular too.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, I'm sure there's something to do with it.
Yeah. Interesting. So, Donald, I wanted to focus on, for one moment, there's some acronyms that you have in your book. Right at the beginning, there's the I Can.
Right.
Can you explain to us what that is?
Yeah. Well, you know, I wanted to really describe what how mindfulness actually works and the elements of it. And so I created an acronym, and it's ICAN, which stands for Intentionally Centering Attention Now. And so these are the four, what I call the catalyzing qualities of awareness that are activated when you start, you know, being mindful. So let's go with the first one, intention. And this is kind of the goal-setting aspect of the mind, and you need intention anytime you're going to be effective in life. Now, believe it or not, you may have unconscious intentions that are happening or that you're just listening to and that may not be in your best interests. But by making your life more intentional and consciously thinking about what you want to do, you can really be more awake and bring into your life what you want. You need intention to break old habits, and you need intention to create a new pathway. So intention is a very powerful change agent when you're talking about mindfulness, okay? Because everything that's in your life right now came about through some intention. I'm guessing the car in your driveway didn't just drive there on its own, right? Or the relationship in your life or anything like that. So if we start using intention as something that we are deciding upon, it can be very powerful. And so the second quality is centering. And I see this as a couple different things. Centering is, on the one hand, being able to look within and find that balance. In other words, like that guy I was telling you about who lost his temper, mindfulness can help us maintain homeostasis of the body and the brain, like a thermostat, and that's that air conditioner idea I was talking about. So you can identify and respond to the stresses that you're inhabiting in your life. Centering is also about an attitude. I think this is important. It's an attitude of openness, an attitude of compassion and spaciousness toward your experiences. So you're not prejudging things. You're just seeing them for what they are in this moment. And that can really help you get more in the flow and have fewer misinterpretations of your reality, for example. So by centering, you're also not being grabbed by compulsive desire or attachment or grasping. You're not being pushing things away, avoiding them, fearing them. So it means that you can you may not be able to change what's happening, but you can accept and engage with whatever is happening in your life. So that's the centering part. The third quality is attention. And attention means really learning how to sharpen the mind's innate faculties. The mind is really amazing. And I look at the mind, and I'm always reminded of this quote by Charles Tarr, and it's actually in the book here. He was one of the early founders of the transpersonal psychology movement, and right now he's very interested in mindfulness work. But he has a quote. He says, you know, and I'm going to paraphrase it. I don't have it exactly. I don't have it right at hand here. But he said, many of us think that life is dull, and so we long ago decided to leave for somewhere better. So, you know, this has to do with us really not kind of rejecting this moment in some even subtle way. And I think that maybe that's something I'd like to talk with you a little bit about after I go through these four, because I think it's a very powerful idea about, you know, not rejecting this moment. But I think that rather than reality being dull, maybe we just need to sharpen our attention like the attention was sharpened to those girls in the eating clinic. So attention is also about harnessing attention, building concentration, because I think our concentration is being how can you say it? Well, it's being splintered. It's being fractured nowadays by all the distractions that we're facing. So this is about building attention, because we need attention to follow through on tasks, and that is about being effective in life. So that's important. It's about mastery, and it's a treasure to protect your attention, because a lot of people are trying to grab your attention, and if you're not careful, they'll have it, and you won't. And the last quality is the now. And this is really important, because in the now, that's where it's like, you know, like where a tire meets the rubber meets the road. That's the kind of idea. I mean, this is where, right here, right now, is where we participate in life. It's where we can find enjoyment. It's where we can devote ourselves 100% to what we're doing. Whether you think it's the most mundane thing in the world, what would it be like if you devoted yourself 100% to washing those dishes, feeling the water on your hands, hearing the sound of the water as it splashed into the sink, paying attention to the colors on the plates? I mean, all of a sudden, you're in this timeless place where you're experiencing something very powerful. It's the idea of even that when you walk, walk when you walk, sit when you sit, but to be there completely. And when you're in the now, I think another important element here is the flexibility that gives you, because you can really respond to what's happening. You're not locked into some old mindset. I love this story. It's, I heard it's a true story about how we can get in fixed mindsets. It's about a woman who, in her family, when they cooked a pot roast, they'd always cut the end off the pot roast. And they never asked why. And but one day this woman decided she was going to find out. So she asked her mother and said, "Mom, why do you cut the end off the pot roast like that? And you put it in the pot?" And she said, "Well, honey, you know, it tastes better this way. Look how, you know, have you ever thought one of my pot roasts wasn't good?" And she says, "No, they've all been great." And, but she wasn't satisfied with that, so she called her grandmother. She said, "Grandma, I know, you know, my mother cuts the ends off the pot roast, and I've seen you do that. Can you tell me why?" And she said, "Well, you know, it just comes out so good, and besides, that's the way my mother did it. So it had to be a good reason." Well, the great-grandmother, believe it or not, was still around. And so she called her great-grandmother and said, "Great-grandma, this is going to be a very odd question I'm going to ask you, but I know that my mother and your daughter, my grandmother, all cut the end of the pot roast, and you did this too, is that right?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, yeah, I did that too." She said, "Can I ask you why?" And she said, "Well, we had a very small pot." So here, everybody just followed along without questioning, without allowing themselves to have the flexibility and really being in this moment where they could make a different choice. And so this is very powerful, and it's a beautiful thing that we can be fluid and be flexible and not impose old ideas over this moment. It's like having it's like taking off sunglasses that have tinted everything. You take them off, and it's like, oh, wow, so this is what it really looks like. And that's what mindfulness can do. It's like taking off those sunglasses. So those are the four that I wanted to. Thanks for asking about that. I hope that explains those. But they're mentioned throughout the book, and they're reinforced throughout the book.
And so I'll just quickly go over that again. The acronym is ICAN, and it stands for Intentionally Centering Attention Now. And I noticed that there is a caller on the line. If you want to get on the air and ask Donald Altman a question, the number is 347-202-0129. That's 347-202-0129. And I noticed there's someone calling from area code 305, but you do not have your hand up. So if you are calling in and you want to get on the air, please do press number 1. That indicates to me that you want to get on the air and you're not just calling in to listen over the phone. So if you do want to get on the air, again, press number 1 when you call in. And so, Donald, there's a couple of things. You wanted to talk about not rejecting the moment, and I'm going to give you space to do that in just a second, but it's interesting what you said about how when we're mindful, it kind of, there's two different things that kind of go on. You mentioned with the girls in the eating disorder clinic, it sounded like when they were being mindful, time sped up. They didn't realize how much time had passed. It had been 15 minutes. But then what about when you are involved in some kind of crisis situation where, you know, like they say your life flashes before your eyes or whatever, and time it's almost like it's going in slow motion. But is that the same thing? I would imagine that your heightened awareness, you're very mindful at that point.
I think it may be the same thing, and it's just because when you're in that heightened awareness, when you're really present, it's almost a timeless time. It's almost like you've entered the timeless eternal now. And so then later you start to think about what that was, and it's really hard because you've left that conventional awareness of time is passing. And when they were in that, I don't know if it was that time sped up for those girls, but when they were in that moment in such a powerful way that they weren't even thinking about time passing. They were just experiencing. So each moment of that now moment, I mean, it in a way it's kind of eternal because it doesn't feel, it doesn't feel like you're not watching the time go by. Does that make sense? In other words, you're not cognizant of the time. You're just experiencing. So in that experiencing moment, time just fades away. I think it becomes kind of irrelevant.
But yeah, that's a really good point. And because I was wondering, is it like the opposite? But what you said about it being timeless is I think that's right on. It reminds me of that that Star Trek, The Next Generation. This is going to totally expose my nerdiness, but
those are good shows. I like those.
There was one episode where that robot guy Data, you know, he'd heard the saying about if you watch a kettle or you watch a pot, it never boils.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept watching it, and he was like, no, it takes, you know, 5 minutes and 32 seconds exactly to boil. And so then he had to turn off his, like, timer so he could experience that. It's kind of the same idea, or not.
Yeah, it is. I like that. There was a lot of wonderful episodes in Star Trek, that's for sure.
Yeah, very so much insight. So we have a question on the air. Are you ready to take it?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, great. So from area code 305, you're on the air. Hello?
Yes. Hi, sorry. The minute to speak you off the loudspeaker.
Hi.
How are you?
Hi.
How are you? Good evening to both. I spoke with you when you came to Positively Incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
About a month ago, and I bought your book, and I think I'm about 9 chapters into the book, but I like to listen to you. It's good.
Oh, well, thank you. Do you have any questions?
Questions?
Or comments are good, too?
It's difficult to stay mindful, just like you were talking about a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
And then we got detoured to, is there a caller on the line and all that. It's difficult to stay mindful. And like you said, people do trap your attention and they keep it.
Well, I'm thank you for bringing that up because I want to make it very clear that mindfulness is what I call re-mindfulness. So it's okay. It's okay to forget, and we just become we remind ourselves to become mindful again. And so it's a process. And but I think it does point
Why is it so difficult to stay in the moment?
Well, and again, I think it's just it's a matter of practice. And I think you will find it easier the more that you do that. There's a little story about a guy who hears that, you know, if he could become mindful for 7 hours, he would get his enlightenment. He goes to this institute, and lo and behold, the first, you know, and they say, well, he says, what do I have to do? And he said, well, follow your breath for 7 hours, and you'll get enlightened.
Right.
He thinks that's great, and he follows his breath for the first second and a half, and it's going great. Then he hears a sound outside, and his sense of hearing goes out, grabs the sound, brings it in his mind. And all of a sudden, he's thinking all these ideas about, oh, you know, that's very rude of them. We're trying to get our mindfulness, our enlightenment, and maybe I should close the window. And then he remembers again that he forgot about his breath. He starts again, and it goes great for about 3 seconds, and, you know, and then a fly buzzes by, and his sense of sight grabs it, brings it in his mind, and there he is, thinking about, well, aren't we going to be eating dinner, and shouldn't somebody know about the flies, and maybe the window's open somewhere, and then it comes back to him, oh, wait, I forgot about my breathing. So, and the story goes that he's still there 10 years later, right, trying to get his 7 hours. So I don't think that we need to be hard on ourselves or anything. I think it just shows you how the world is full of distractions, but we can start to build up more and more practice. And as we start doing this, I think it does get to be easier, and you reach a point where you're more able to take that breath, be in the present moment, and focus with what's happening. And it's also, I think, about setting some boundaries with some of the distractions and taking an assessment of your day, of your life, and saying, okay, I mean, how much, I think technology is great, but I do set some boundaries with it. And I think that we need face-to-face time. We need resource time with other people. We need time just to be alone, to embrace silence, time to be with nature. And so if you're not allowing yourself to have those times, then it could be more difficult too. So I think how we decide to nurture mindfulness is important. We can cultivate it and find ways of nurturing it. For example, you might want to try just to spend you know, a couple hours on a Saturday when you have a little time off to just say, okay, I'm going to try to spend two hours here, or even just an hour of just, you know, being intentional with what I do, reading, paying attention to my body, making conscious choices, and just seeing if I can be mindful for this time. You know, it's very much like deciding to, you know, what the whole idea of the Sabbath is about. And
right.
Just allowing yourself to stop doing for a little bit and just to be present. So don't get down on yourself. Don't be hard on yourself. This is a process, and the fact that you're at chapter 9, I applaud you. I think that's fantastic. Thank you.
Well, I really like that meditation where all the people that you love support you, and all the masters, and even your deceased pets. I thought that was really beautiful. I'm going to try that.
Thank you. Yeah, that is very powerful.
Well, thank you so much for calling in.
The program, I was going to say, just like your program, Namaste.
Thank you so much. Namaste. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was lovely and a great question. And we also have one more question in the chat room. And we'll see how you respond to this. What does it mean to be mindful?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I'm all about trying actually to expand our vocabulary on what that means. And so I think it'd be real easy to give one short answer, but I think it could be expanded. I mean, basically, I think mindfulness is about being very much in the here and now, in awareness of the body, awareness of your thoughts, awareness of your relationships, and awareness of your purpose. I think awareness of your purpose is important. And if you're present with that and in an open and a non-judgmental kind of way, not taking sides, not being impartial, but just being open and accepting, then there's a good chance you're being true to the heart of, you know, touching mindfulness.
So, Donald, just to expand on that a little bit, is mindfulness, is it necessarily totally not having any thoughts in your head, or can you still be thinking mindful?
Sure, you can definitely still be thinking and be mindful. You can be noticing your thoughts. In other words, I kind of see it like this, that there's, you know, we have different kinds of consciousness. You know, there's an eye consciousness, an ear consciousness, and there's taste, and there's consciousness of thought. But we also have the ability. And so those are like, you could almost think of those as like, as consciousness in that way, as a light, like a flashlight that shines on things, and then the light reflects back. We experience it, okay? Mindfulness is like an inner light that shines on this other light. I call it kind of an inner sight awareness. So it's an inner light that shines on all other awarenesses. You're not doing anything else. It's just there. And that inner light or that inner sight awareness, for example, when I would be struggling with food, I could watch the struggle using my inner sight awareness. That part of me wasn't feeling emotionally wounded with food or anything. It was just observing. And so we have that ability. It's this kind of just this very core centered part of ourselves that is present, and we can get in touch with it more and more. And I think, so I hope, does that answer your question?
It answers mine. Sylvia Slipstream in the chat room, does that answer your question? I'll give her a moment to respond to that.
Oh, okay.
We have another caller on the line. Are you ready to take another call?
Sure thing.
Okay, great. So from area code 941, you're on the air. What's your question?
Yeah, I have a question and a brief comment, if you don't mind. Actually, I practice meditation in my own way, and I teach meditation in my own way. I think there's a lot of politics into meditation and a lot of those words anyway. But having said that, my question is that, it is really hard for me to understand, and maybe the gentleman can enlighten me how can we, you know, we all choose, okay? So in order to make choices, we all have to make judgments. So unless we play it with our words, we're always judgmental. Whatever you take right or left on the red light, which friend you're going to have, you're not going to friend. As long as you're part of this three-dimensional universe with our five senses, if we're going to not be eaten by a tiger, we have to noise. For let's say you're a yogi, you meditate, you know, inner awareness and all that stuff. But you have to, your conscious observer that makes always choices has to be aware in order to protect you from the tiger that comes out of the leaves, from the corner of the jungle. So, no matter how mindful we are, and there's a lot of ways of saying that, you can say sense of oneness, the observer effect, sense of detachment, sense of wholeness, all those things that really tap into the transcendent aspect of ourselves. It may be there, but always we live in this part of this world in order if we want to survive, if we want to be a part of it, because if we were all of us be able to lose ourselves in bliss or peace and not be aware of our environment, we're going to be eaten by the tiger. So I just want to say that the conscious observer makes always choices, is always judgmental, because we have to always, take action to survive. So it is a good tool. And I haven't heard your program or the whole of it, but I have a lot of great friends that they're Buddhist, and I think we all a little bit Buddhist inside. But I really have a problem with that issue, where a sense of denial out of the fact that we are living in that choice-based universe in the same way, and the better choices we make, the better judgments we make, the happier lives we're going to have. We are always a judgment. I choose to meditate. I choose to forgive. I choose to be empathetic and live in. I choose to eat better and to have more reverence and sense of flow into my life, harmony and peace. So the choice is always there. I choose to let go. I choose to focus on sense of oneness and unity and transcendence. So
it sounds like your question, correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like your question is, how do you balance the obvious need for our brains for
you
survival?
You don't balance anything, but if there is there.
And with the also the need to clear our minds as well.
Well, there are a couple different things here. One, I agree with the caller that, and thank you for the question. I agree with the caller that, that sometimes we can use meditative practices to escape, and I don't advise that. I think we need to participate in the world, and we do need to make choices. I mean, he's talking about he makes choices to meditate. He's trying to reduce his suffering in some way. He tries to do other things that he was talking about. So I think that when we're faced with suffering, we can choose things that can help alleviate that. I think that what he was talking about judgment, though, is I think that, you know, there's different kinds of judgment. When I'm talking about non-judgmentalness or openness or neutrality, that's very different from discernment. So if I'm going to go buy a product, I have to use discernment, which is a form of judgment. So which is going to be best? There are value here and so on and so forth. And we need that. So these things coexist. These, as I said before, we live in a conventional world and we need to operate within that. And at the same time, we can also look at how we can reduce suffering. And I think the reason why mindfulness is important is because it reduces suffering. It reduces our suffering. It may not change our situation, but it can help us reduce our suffering as we're experiencing that. It can change our relationship with it. And that's not escape, but I think it's a strategy that makes a lot of sense. And it's compassionate toward ourselves, too.
So, Donald, it sounds like there's a difference between, because we are using, our minds are constantly making judgments. We assess, like within an instant, we come up with an opinion about something.
Right.
But there's a difference between, like you said, discernment, which serves us.
Yeah.
And we want to use that judgment skill for discernment and choosing. But there's also the judgments that don't serve us, and I think that's
right. And there's also sometimes the war that goes on in the mind. And I think anybody who's ever experienced addiction, for example, or cravings, and has tried to deal with that, or any kind of habit in your life where you're like, oh, I don't want to do it, I want it, I don't. Right? And there's this war back and forth, and. You know, you could look at that and say, well, you know, how do I get past that? And that's where mindfulness can help transcend certain kinds of mental, you know, war, mental fight, mental judgment, so to speak. But, yeah, I think that we need to know when we're just making a decision, and that's just discernment. But if we're... you can also think of the word judgment as meaning that you're either avoiding something, I don't want it, or I fear it, or I crave it. Those are other kinds of judgments that have to do with basic causes of suffering. And so there are different, we can start to learn the difference between those. And that can be very helpful.
And Donald, we just have a few minutes left in the show, so I wanted to, because you wanted to talk about not rejecting the moment.
Oh, right. So rejecting the moment, what I was going to say is that a lot of times you may be somewhere and you're thinking you really don't want to be there. And that could have to do with, it could even be like, you know, you're having a dinner with somebody and you're thinking, oh, you know, I could be with someone else. Or maybe you don't want your dinner. You want what they're having, what they're eating. And so this goes many, many different ways that we subtly, in some way, reject what's happening to us. And I just want to share a quick story about that. When I was at my office one time, and I had a break in between what happened was somebody canceled. My office is a few blocks from the river in Portland area. And so I thought I'd go down there and meditate and get centered, and it's going to be a good, nice walking meditation. When I got down there and I started walking, I realized how chilly it was, and I started thinking, my mind started thinking about, oh, I should have brought a jacket, and it's really kind of cold here. But then I started trying to walk again, and then I heard these kids in a nearby park, and they were making a lot of noise, and my mind came in, and it said, oh, you know, this is, how can you concentrate, and these kids are making so much noise, they're really loud, and so something really interesting happened was I had a very subtle, what I call mind whispers, a thought that came along, a very subtle intention. It said, go back to the office. It's warmer, more comfortable there, quieter, you'll have a better meditation. And if we're not careful, if we're not paying close attention to these, to our mind whispers or to our intention, intentional awareness, then we can just follow that, almost like a robot, like you're in a hypnotic trance. And but I caught it, and I heard it, I was like, and I stopped in my tracks, Marie, and I started to laugh. Oh, and I remember thinking, oh, so this moment isn't good enough. And I was going to reject it for somewhere else. And then what happened was I was just, I started walking again and just let it all in. I accepted it all. I didn't try to push any of it away. And so I was there with the cold chill on my face, my arms. I was there with the kids and their little screeching and playing or whatever that was. I was present with all of it in that moment, and it was just wonderful because I accepted it in. I let it all in instead of resisting it. Often I think it's where we resist that we suffer the most, where we resist or reject that is in our life, that is where we cause pain.
It's like, I'm going to use another analogy. It's like when you know you have to do your taxes and you put it off and you put it off, and it's like nagging and kind of hovering over you. Oh, God, I got to do my taxes. And then when you actually sit down to do your taxes, for most people, it doesn't even take that long.
Right, yeah.
But you've suffered for, you know, 2 months knowing that you need to do them.
That's a wonderful way of
instead of just doing it.
Yeah, that's a wonderful way of looking at how we can produce suffering for ourselves. So in other words, there's the idea that there is, I'm not saying that doing the taxes is a fun thing and you can't wait to do it, but there are things in life that can cause discomfort or may cause pain of some kind, but the suffering, that part that you're talking about, is optional. And so we can start to notice when we're creating that. And we can also learn how to let that go or let it be.
Well, Donald, it has been such a pleasure talking with you, and we're just about out of time. And we've had such a wonderful conversation. I'm sure that there's so much more that could be said, and there's so many more wonderful points and exercises in your book, The Mindfulness Code, Keys for Overcoming Stress, Anxiety, Fear, and Unhappiness. And I'm wondering if there's anything that you would like to leave us with that hasn't been said yet.
Well, it's been wonderful, Marie. I really enjoyed being here with you. And I just want to mention that if people wanted to go to mindfulnesscode.com, they can get some free downloads of some of the meditations from the two CDs, Mindfulness Code CDs that I have, too.
Oh, wonderful.
That's at mindfulnesscode.com. But thank you so much, and many blessings to you and your listeners.
You're welcome. Thank you. So it is not mindfulness, not the mindfulness, but mindfulness.com.
Mindfulnesscode.com.
Mindfulnesscode.com, rather. Okay. Thank you so much for being with us, Donald.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Be well. Take care.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye. So again, that was Donald Altman. You can find him at mindfulnesscode.com. The name of the book is The Mindfulness Code, Keys for Overcoming Stress, Anxiety, Fear, and Unhappiness. What a great hour. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you to those of you who called in. I love taking your calls. It's such a pleasure to hear your voice and have your questions. And also thank you to the people who were participating in the chat room with their questions and their hellos. So I hope you have a wonderful evening. Just a reminder, next week, starting next week, which is beginning of August, the show is going to be live at 1 p.m. Pacific time, that's 4 p.m. Eastern time, rather than the current time, which starts normally at 7 p.m. Pacific. We've changed the time because we're hoping more people on the East Coast will be able to join us in the afternoon here at 1 o'clock on the West Coast. So again, that's 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern time for our live shows. And who is up next week? Let me just take a look at my calendar here. The Novice, we're going to have another former monk, and he will be speaking about what he learned and why he decided to leave. So thank you so much for being with us again. Be well. Please join us next Tuesday, 1 p.m. Pacific time. Namaste.
Thank you for joining with us for this hour of Namaste Radio. For further spiritual insights and sharing, please join us in Namaste Global Community at namastepublishing.com. If you enjoyed the show, please add Namaste Radio as a friend, favorite the show, and tell someone about it. Sharing this show is a precious gift that's completely free. Thank you. May you enjoy each moment of your day. Namaste.